at some protection from the wind. As night fell, Kylie groped for any useful thoughts, but her struggle with her emotional reactions was not going well. There had been little in her life to prepare her for such an event. Her racing experience had been with a competent, well-equipped professional crew, and she had been able to depend on them if anything happened. Now she was adrift with no food, no water, no clothing, no signaling devices, nothing but what they were wearing. The closest Kylie came to survival thinking that first night was when a ship passed near them. While the others were cheering wildly, "The reality of our situation came back into focus," Kylie wrote later. She knew that the chances of their being spotted, even by the Coast Guard, were low at night. She understood that they were on their own. She was thinking analytically, assessing her situation, and accepting reality. She was able to face the notion that she would have to take responsibility for her own survival. At one point, Mark complained that Kylie was kicking him, and knowing that she wasn't, she ducked underwater to see what he was feeling. "A cold sword of fear stabbed through me. I didn't believe what I was seeing. Sharks. There were sharks everywhere." There could not have been a better lure for sharks than the inverted boat with all those legs dangling down and trailing Meg's blood. Soon the boat was upright and everybody was inside it. But now, exposed to the wind, they were in danger of hypothermia. After that, they were harried by sharks on into the next day. They nearly flipped the boat when, fearing a shark attack, everyone moved to the same side at once. There was no discipline, no leadership, no plan, and a lot of screaming and fighting. Emotion was a loose and loaded cannon. Kylie was not immune to it either, but she kept trying to direct her thoughts and control her emotion. Her success was limited at first, but at least she was engaged in a struggle. Without the effort of struggle, a person is done for. Just as James Stockdale recommends a course of familiarization with pain, and Mark Morey observed that children without knowledge of predators don't do as well in survival school, so people who have not had to struggle in their lives are at risk. While the other crew members veered wildly from hysteria to giddiness to deep depression and angry, irrational arguing among themselves, Kylie fought to consolidate something inside herself. "I closed my eyes, trying to get away from their death masks, from the sharks, from everything." She was looking within herself for balance. It was there, and the evidence is in her state of mind in the moments after impact, which resembled Callahan's in the first few minutes after Solo sank. "My mind seemed trapped in this rapid-fire volley," Kylie reported. "Thoughts rocketing by like sniper's bullets. Control," I said to myself. "I must maintain control." She would, but it would take work and time. Even so, as if by some long-forgotten schooling, she began doing some of the right things almost immediately. Struggling to achieve that essential state of grace and poise, she began praying to keep herself focused. Survival psychologists have long observed that successful survivors pray, even when they don't believe in a god. Kylie tried to organize the crew to scoop some warm seawater into the dinghy to protect them from the cold wind, but her efforts were fruitless. When Mark Adams thought he saw their lost life raft, everyone flew into a frenzy of paddling with their hands, wasting precious energy. At last, Kylie hit on the idea that they could cover themselves with seaweed for warmth. An inventive approach to using the materials at hand is a hallmark of survivor thinking. Although it was a good idea and eventually worked, Mark's initial response was, "I don't want that slimy shit on me." You can often tell early on who is going to make it and who is not. If Kylie's story had been a Hollywood movie, everyone in the audience would know by now that Mark was going to die. Meanwhile, Brad Kavanaugh was sitting alone by himself on the bow of the boat, shouting at the sky, "Fuck you, God, fuck you, you fucking bastard." He was doing the opposite of going inside himself, where survival begins. Epictetus wrote, "You must either cultivate your own ruling faculty or external things. You must either exercise your skill on internal things or on external things. That is, you must either maintain the position of a philosopher or that of a common person. And the condition and characteristic of a philosopher is this: he expects all advantage and all harm from himself. He doesn't blame others, nor turn to them. He takes responsibility for himself. Epictetus, one of the great Stoic thinkers, was writing a survival manual. And what he said was this: if you want to be a survivor, be a philosopher. Kavanaugh blamed something outside himself for his predicament. He was not looking within for consolation and consolidation, for opportunity and strength. All five crew members were quite literally dying. They were progressing through Kubler-Ross's stages: denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and acceptance. But although it is instructive to compare their behavior to Callahan's, who was not dying but surviving, it mattered little what they did. Through lack of proper preparation, they had no water. Without rescue, they would perish. It's not uncommon. On the contrary, as John Leach has observed, people will quite simply ignore the possibility that a particular disaster will ever strike them. Some people subconsciously believe that to prepare for disaster is to encourage it. Don't even think about it, for fear that it may come to pass. Kylie continued intermittently to grasp at her inner instinct for survival, but she was continually pulled back toward thinking and behavior that could be deadly. She entered into a phase of bargaining, telling God, "If you get me through this, I'll try to do better." Many victims have perished waiting for God to help them out, instead of recognizing that, whether or not you believe in a God, you must help yourself. Still, she was doing her best, struggling to think like a survivor. When she found that the seaweed with which they'd covered themselves sustained a vast number of tiny creatures, "I was dazzled by the life it supported. An entire world, self-sufficient and complete." To be open to the world in which you find yourself, to be able to experience wonder at its magnificence, is to begin to admit its reality and adapt to it. Be here now. It is to place yourself in relation to it, to say, "Before I came here, the world was as it is now. After I am gone, it will be that way still." To experience wonder is to know this truth: the world won't adapt to me. I must adapt to it. To experience humility is the true survivor's correct response to catastrophe. A survival emergency is a Rorschach test. It will quickly tell you who you are. What Debbie Kiley perceived was this: "I was frightened by the way I seemed to be losing control of my thoughts." She understood at a deep level the need to gain the upper hand, the high ground of the forebrain. Meanwhile, Mark Adams was still screaming. "Didn't anyone tell them we were fucking out here?" he raved. He had no idea who might have told them or who they were. He didn't plan for the situation because he didn't know his own world or take responsibility for himself. He expected the world to adapt to him, to take care of him. At the same time, John Lipoth had fallen into a stupor, and Meg was succumbing to her injuries. As darkness fell again, Kylie let her thoughts take her to another world, a refuge that survivors seek, which can help them to regroup and gain energy. Long-term memory. There was a ball game in a mowed green field, and children on backyard swings, and dogs barking, and cars turning into driveways, she recalled. The struggle to survive can rapidly deplete your resources. Balancing emotion and reason can be like teetering on top of a big ball, requiring touch, timing, and a continuous shift of weight and energy. The phenomenon may have something to do with stimulation of the amygdala, too. Ian Glynn, author of An Anatomy of Thought, wrote that hallucinations in which the patient relives past experiences may be elicited by stimulation of the amygdala. Hallucinations are frequently reported by survivors. That retreat into memory, fantasy, or mind games can bring relief and rest. It may also help that the brain can do its work on something familiar when all the normal cues are stripped away. In the brain's desperate struggle to place you back in the world, it can bring out memories of hospitable environments the organism can tolerate. The struggle to adapt to such a hostile world can be exhausting, and memory of a benign environment can provide a necessary refuge. Henri Charrière, the French writer and convict better known as Papillon, was condemned to life in the infamous penal colony on Devil's Island. He wrote, "Once I was truly exhausted, I stretched out on my back and wrapped the blanket around my head. What indescribable sensations! I spent nights of love more intense than the real ones. I could sit down with my mother, dead these 17 years. I was there. It wasn't imagination." He escaped from the island, first in his mind and eventually in real life. But without training or knowledge of survival, without something in her background to anchor her, Debbie Kiley was unable to grasp what was happening to her. Still, she was in better shape than the others. She felt empathy for Meg, for example. She knew that surely Meg would die, and wondered if she was thinking about home right now. Empathy is an important quality for a survivor. Kylie's desire to aid Meg may have helped her feel less like a victim. It may have given her at least some sense of personal power. Whereas Steve Callahan had begun his solo voyage with the understanding that he had to take care of himself, in Kylie's group, no one had worked out beforehand who was in charge, who was responsible. Certainly not the captain, Lipoth. Routine, rules, emergency procedures were all left to chance. Now they were all thinking outside themselves, hoping that some mysterious force would come down and snatch them out of their nightmare. The failure to adapt was killing them. After a time, Brad Kavanaugh began making an effort to rise above the group and his own emotions. He had gotten up on the windward side of the gunwale to prevent the boat from flipping. He'd been very quiet. Brad sat stone-faced and silent up on the side of the Zodiac. He had his mission. He was the balancer of the boat. He was separating himself from the group's poisonous dynamics and consolidating something within himself to resist their descent into madness. Significantly, he did it by giving himself a job, a purpose, a small task. The situation was very bad. They were hurt, exhausted, hypothermic, and had no water. 2 days out, their pain was scarcely imaginable, and some were less than 24 hours from death. More and more often now, people in the group were saying, "I can't take it." But that is the exact opposite of what a survivor would say to himself. Christopher Burney, the British officer who was held in Buchenwald and other German prison camps, was kept in solitary confinement for years during World War II. At first, he told himself he'd be out by Christmas. When Christmas passed, he hoped to be released by Easter. When that too passed and summer came, "I dismissed my old impatience from my mind," he wrote in solitary confinement, "seeing such promise in the summer weather that no reservation with its hidden pessimism was now necessary. I could be patient for 3 more months. That is the way a survivor thinks. When I was working in maximum security prisons in the early 1980s, I remember one convict telling me, "I could do a nickel standing on my head." When I asked how he did it, he said, "You got to stay inside your mind." That's survivor thinking. Yossi Ginsberg, a young Israeli hiker who was traveling on a raft downriver and then got swept into rapids in the Bolivian jungle, stumbled into a pit of quicksand during his 3rd week of peregrinations. As he lay gasping for breath after having struggled out, he told himself, "I'll suffer any torment, but I'll go on." There are few perfect survivors. Steve Callahan may be one. There are many, though, who flail around at first, then get their minds right and live. As the group deteriorated even further, as it became obvious that Meg was dying, Kylie fought harder for control. She was not going to give up, and that marked her at last as a survivor. At one point, she covered her head with a rubber spray curtain near the boat's bow to separate myself from them, to keep myself together. They were dragging me down, filling my head with black thoughts. She attempted to forge a team with Brad Kavanaugh, the only other crew member who wasn't mad by now. "Brad," she said, "I need you." He put his head under the apron with her, and they made a pact. One of them would sleep while the other stood guard. It was simple, but for the first time it began to define some measure of control and to separate the survivors from the victims. It gave them a simple task, a short-term goal, a purpose, and a commitment to someone outside themselves. It also solidified enough coldness in their hearts to let go of the other three crew members to do whatever was necessary. Their empathy could now be directed toward each other and no one else. Like an immune system, it defined the inside and the outside, and by being responsible to each other, neither had to feel like the victim. Years later, when I asked Kylie how she and Brad Kavanaugh had survived, she told me, "I got Brad on the boat, and I felt like it was my job to keep him alive. And I think he thought the same about me. Brad and I had a little rule. If I'm asleep, you're awake, and if you're asleep, then I'm awake." With that, Kylie at last began consolidating what she had, examining her resources, mapping her world, and adapting to it. She remembered her high school English teacher, Mr. Pittman. He had taken the class on wilderness trips and talked about survival. I hadn't thought about him in years. Perhaps there was something in her background she could use. "No one is coming," she told herself. "I had to face facts. We all did. We were on our own." By then, Adams had gone completely simple. Seeing a cut on Kylie's foot, he tried to twist her toe off, telling her, "It's so infected, it's just going to fall off anyway." Kylie was unmoved. I looked away. The sight of them made me sick. To survive, you must at some point allow cool to become cold. Stockdale wrote, "In difficult situations, the leader with the heart, not the soft heart, not the bleeding heart, but the Old Testament heart, the hard heart, comes into his own." Survival means accepting reality, and accepting reality takes a hard heart. But it is a strange kind of coldness, for it has empathy at its center. Survivors discover a deep spiritual relationship to the world. They often have a talisman to connect them with it, a sort of lifeline from inner to outer reality. Debbie Kylie found her spiritual side and her talisman in the memory of an old sailor who had told her that if a sailor wearing a black pearl was ever lost at sea, he could trade it to Poseidon for his life. After hearing that, she had bought a black pearl earring, which she still wore. "Now I reached up and touched the earring. I fingered the pearl." She took it off and threw it into the sea. When Brad asked her what she was doing, she said nothing. She recognized, too, her need for privacy, to keep certain things for yourself and maintain that consolidated identity, that sacred inner core of selfhood. Orwell's novel 1984 is in part about how Winston Smith gradually loses that sacred core. In group survival, we all need privacy. The immune system itself tells us and what is the rest of the world, as do emotions. Privacy is essential to life. Life itself can be seen as arising from a self-organizing force that gathers certain materials, hoards and tends them, and protects them from becoming part of the rest of the world, even while delicately interacting with, finding a place in, taking from, and giving to the world. Privacy is life, but so is community. It's another balancing act, to have boundaries and not be completely alone. At times when nature is trying to reclaim the materials of life, to turn you into the raw stuff of the world for its eternal tinkering, you have to cling to what is yours and yours alone, even while committing to another. That may be the meaning of a talisman. This is me, this is my stuff. Yossi Ginsberg clung to a little book that his uncle had given him. Steve Callahan clung to his Boy Scout knife. Kylie clung to her black pearl and committed it to Poseidon. She made a pact between herself and the sea. Although Kylie was beginning to find a calm within herself, she still had at best a tenuous hold on it, and at times found herself asking one of the deadliest questions of all. Why this? Why now? Why me? Gratitude, humility, wonder, imagination, and cold, logical determination. Those are the survivor's tools of mind. Kylie was asleep when Brad woke her urgently on the morning of the third day. They watched as John and Mark leaned over the side and drank their fill of seawater. "I felt such sadness listening to them," Kylie wrote. "They had given in. They had lost control. I knew that drinking seawater was a terrible mistake." Even as they gave up their struggle, Kylie seemed to strengthen. She began to experience the all-important split of personality, that paradox of hope and resignation which characterizes survivors. "Maybe the Coast Guard was coming after all," she told herself, answering, "Don't be a fool, Debbie. They aren't coming. That's all there is to it. I will help myself," I thought. "All I have is myself. I will not fall apart." By late afternoon, as Lipoth, Meg, and Adams all indulged in complaint and bickering, Adams suddenly began searching the seaweed in the bottom of the boat. "Where are my fucking cigarettes?" he asked. When Kylie told him there were no cigarettes, he grew angry. "I just went to the 7-Eleven and I bought beer and cigarettes, and I want to know who took them." Meanwhile, Lipoth began deliberately kicking Meg, who was already in terrible pain from her wounds. As Adams continued to search, Lipoth began peeling away a patch on the inflated tubing that was keeping them afloat. "My knees buckled," Kylie wrote. "I knew the next second the air would come hissing out of the Zodiac." Fortunately, the patch he had pulled off wasn't crucial, but clearly both Lipoth and Adams had gone over the edge. He had no idea what he had done. His eyes were flat and dull. Soon Lipoth and Adams were having a conversation that left Kavanaugh and Kylie mystified. Lipoth asked Adams if he wanted a smoke, and Lipoth said, "Sure. I got some sandwiches. You want one?" According to Nathaniel Philbrick's In the Heart of the Sea, a history of the whaling ship Essex, on which Melville's Moby Dick was based, it is not uncommon for castaways who have been many days at sea and suffered both physically and emotionally to lapse into what has been called a sort of collective confabulation, in which the survivors exist in a shared fantasy world. Delusions may include comforting scenes from home. Lipoth's brain, overloaded with sodium, told him that he was in an entirely different environment, and the result of losing that connection with his world killed him. The feeble, flickering circuitry of his brain seized on whatever was close at hand in recent memory. He was back on Trashman now, and they were at the docks. It was so vivid, it literally blotted out the evidence of his senses. Lipoth acted on that imagined world. He began talking about going to get the car so they could unload. "You guys bring the boat in and I'll get the car." He climbed over the side of the Zodiac into the water. "I'll be back in a few," he said matter-of-factly. The sun was setting as he hung there, clinging to the boat. "I can't take this anymore," he said. "I'm going to get the car." Then he swam away. Kavanaugh and Kylie stared in horrified disbelief. They briefly discussed whether they should try to get him, but it was already too dark and they knew there were sharks everywhere. As they watched him ride over the swells, they heard a terrible gut-twisting scream as Lipoth was eaten alive. Remark reported a remarkably similar incident in All Quiet on the Western Front of a young soldier reacting to combat. "I have been watching him for a long time, grinding his teeth and opening and shutting his fists. These hunted, protruding eyes, we know them too well. He had collapsed like a rotten tree. Now he stands up, stealthily creeps across the floor, hesitates a moment, and then glides toward the door. I intercept him and say, "Where are you going?" "I'll be back in a minute," says he, and tries to push past me. Which would not have been so extraordinary except for the fact that they were in a bunker, and outside that door, the bombardment extends undiminished as far as the artillery lines. In the middle of Kylie's night of horror, Adams got on top of Meg, who was near death, covered with sores and horribly infected wounds. "Hey, lady," he said, "I think it's about time you and me had sex." When she started weeping, Adams screamed, "Fuck you, fuck you, I'm tired of playing games. I'm going back to the 7-Eleven to get some cigarettes." Then he, too, slipped over the side. Soon they could actually feel the sharks eating Adams beneath the dinghy. "The bow lifted up, then dropped back down," Kylie reported. "The dinghy spun around. I was paralyzed with terror." Years later, Kylie told me, "That is the only time in my life I felt like I was just walking down that fine line of sanity. Here's Mark. He's overboard. The sharks are eating him. Meg's dying. It's in the middle of the night, and it's the first night that the stars are out. It was just very haunting." Noticing the stars, the beauty of the sky, was a significant sign of strength. For although Kylie walked the line, she did not slip over it, as Lipoth and Adams had done. Instead, she continued to struggle to consolidate her inner strength, to adapt and survive. A crucial moment for all survivors comes when they become convinced that they will survive. Often, it occurs after a spiritual experience of the beauty of the world. "When I was out there and people started to die," Kylie told me, "I knew that I wasn't going to die. It was just a matter of figuring out how." She concentrated on the sky and on her praying. "Focus on the sky," she told herself. "On the beauty there." Once again, she experienced the hardness survivors need in order to carry on amid the horror. "I knew Meg was going to die soon, and God forgive me, I felt relief. She was the last weak link. Once Meg was gone, it would be Brad and me. We would be at square one, able to concentrate completely upon staying alive. And at that moment, I knew with startling and absolute certainty that I was not going to die." Facing down horror, finding beauty, then feeling certainty. Every survivor describes the same pattern. In the stages of dying, the last step is acceptance. In survival, it is total commitment. Every survivor I spoke with said that there was a moment of revelation in which he was suddenly seized by the certainty that he would live. Mary Joss was on the 78th floor of the South Tower of the World Trade Center when the wingtip of United Flight 175 sliced through the sky lobby, killing nearly everyone standing there waiting for the elevators with her. She was unconscious for a time, burned and bleeding. When she came to and saw the destruction and fire around her, she thought of her husband and told herself, "I am not going to die." She got out. It had taken Kylie 3 days, but she had made the successful transition from victim to survivor. She and Kavanaugh took turns sleeping. She felt the calm and control of the rescuer. "I would stay here like this, watching him until he woke up, making sure he didn't drown in the swill." Now they were on the voyage of survival. Paradoxically, they didn't need to be rescued. Certainly their bodies would die sometime, perhaps soon if they weren't rescued. But they'd come to terms with their world. There is an old Zen story about a young man who passionately wants to become a master swordsman. He goes to the Kundo master and begs to be taught. But the master puts him to work in the garden instead. Every time the student isn't looking, the master sneaks up behind him and whacks him with a stick. The student is terribly frustrated, and this goes on for months, then years. No matter what the student does, he can't seem to sense when the master is behind him, and he is constantly covered with bruises. But then one day, The student is in the garden, as usual, hoeing and weeding, and the master sneaks up behind him. He swings, the student ducks. The master misses. The student is overjoyed. He leaps up and shouts, "Now will you teach me swordsmanship?" "Now you don't need swordsmanship," the master says. When I first heard that story, I almost wept, because it seemed so much like me and my father. Meg Mooney died at last, and they took her shirt for extra clothing and stripped off her jewelry to return it to her family. Then they let her slide over the side. That beautiful young woman, who had been so stylish and bubbly in her sunglasses and bikini just days before, floated face down until she drifted out of sight, returning her borrowed materials to the Silver Sea. By the time they saw another ship, Kylie had completely accepted her new world. Kavanaugh wanted to try to signal, but she told him, "Don't waste your energy. It'll never see us." Maurice and Marilyn Bailey had a remarkably similar response after 3.5 months adrift. They saw a ship, and Marilyn wanted to signal. Maurice said, "Let it go on. This is our world now on the sea, amongst the birds and the turtles and the fish." As Dostoevsky wrote in Memoirs from the House of the Dead, "Man is a creature who can get used to anything, and I believe that is the very best way of defining him." Survival is a simple test. There's only one right answer, but cheating is allowed. And in the end, Debbie Kylie passed. A Russian freighter picked her and Kavanaugh up after 5 days. It's easy to die without water in 3. Their positive mental attitude kept them both alive. I asked her what advice she had for others. "Trust your gut," she said. "I had my misgivings about the trip all along. It just didn't feel right. So I have just one piece of advice for people. Your gut tells you what to do. Believe it. I didn't, and a lot of people are dead, and I have to live with it. Also, never forget that you can't depend on anybody. You really have to have it within yourself to do it." 12. A View of Heaven. On his first full day adrift, Steve Callahan began a diary. Notes on his health, the condition of the raft, and the status of his supplies. He was orderly. He set small tasks. He took responsibility and focused tightly. But he never lost his sense of humor. "I continue to make light of whatever I can in order to relieve the tension. Leadership, order, and routine are all important elements of survival. Callahan had established all 3 before 24 hours had passed. Even so, at that early stage, his hold on himself was fragile. From time to time, he'd succumb to attacks of emotion, which he had to fight to control. Yet his grip on reason, his ability to think clearly and in a practical way, is remarkable. "Desperation shakes me. I want to cry, but scold myself, hold it back, choke it down. You cannot afford the luxury of water wept away. Survival. Concentrate on survival," he told himself. Callahan would think of home and future plans and happy times, especially meals. But it was early in his ordeal, and he didn't yet know that such thoughts were normal. He'd scold himself to stop. He was a hard taskmaster. John Leach uses the term active passiveness, meaning the ability to accept the situation one is in, but without giving into it. In a survival situation, there is a lot of waiting, and there should be a lot of resting as well. To do that well takes self-control and training, but learning to wait can also help to prevent boredom and hopelessness from setting in. Jackie Mann, one of the Westerners kidnapped by Arab terrorists in Beirut, found that a big part of his job was to learn his captor's capacity for waiting and patience. Ultimately, it is the struggle that keeps one alive. What seems a paradox is simply the act of living. Never stop struggling. Life itself is a paradox, gathering order out of the chaos of matter and energy. When the struggle ceases, we die. Scientists have long observed the seeming mystery. you can will yourself to die. So it was just as important that Callahan desire to be somewhere better as it was that he snap himself back to the reality of his situation. Gradually he understood. But the desire to dream lingers. It is my one relief. True, you can't give yourself up to it, but you can use it and even enjoy it. Survival depends on utility, but it also depends on joy, for joy is the organism telling itself that it is all right. Paradoxically, his personality was disintegrating and consolidating at the same time. He was noticing the split all survivors feel, and he notes in his book that the distinction between the mental and physical parts of myself continues to grow sharper. He finds that he must coldly force himself to think rationally and force himself to work. I try to comply with contradictory demands, but I know the other parts of me have bent to my cold, hard rationalism as best they can. I am slowly losing the ability to command, and if it goes, I am lost. I carefully watch for signs of mutiny within myself. Callahan recounts a conversation he had with his captain. He asked for water, and the captain said, "Shut up. We don't know how close we are. Might have to last to the Bahamas. Now get back to work." "But Captain, you heard me. You've got to stay on ration." Nearly all survivors report hearing what they call the voice. It tells them what to do. It is the speaking, rational side of the brain, the one that processes language, the wellspring of reason. Callahan had a huge advantage over most recreational survivors because he had already had such experiences in the course of following his passion for sailing. He had learned, perhaps unconsciously at first, to effect the split while sailing, dividing himself into what Joseph Ledoux calls the mental trilogy of emotion, cognition, and motivation. When I am in danger or injured, my emotional self feels fear and my physical self feels pain. I instinctively rely on my rational self to take command over the fear and pain. But under extreme stress, he begins to find that what he had experienced as three selves working together are becoming dissociated. My rational commander relies on hope, dreams, and cynical jokes to relieve the tension in the rest of me. The sort of discipline he describes is part of the process of wrenching some sort of order out of chaos. It is the basic process of life, only here with much more energy at stake because the system is being driven so much harder than it normally is. He set his water ration at half a pint a day. To take only a mouthful every 6 hours or so is difficult discipline. I have decided not to drink seawater. Pondering the whale that may have sunk him, Callahan recalled other whales he'd seen at sea. Suddenly there's a huge beast there, and at that moment a profound emotion, not fear, rises from the depths of my soul. It is like seeing a friend whom I thought I'd never see again, who miraculously appears. I feel a wonderful electricity in the air, an aura of immense intelligence and sensitivity. I recalled the lifeguard Mike Crowder in Kauai telling me about the mana coming off a surfer as he walked past. You hear things like that, and at first they sound silly. But you hear enough survivors of impossible situations say it, and you become a believer. Cynicism isn't in the lexicon of nature. Animals, natural forces, are frank. Survivors, therefore, must have spirituality and humility. As Callahan puts it, "I believe in the miraculous and spiritual way of things. I do not know the true workings of that way. I can only guess and hope that it includes me." All the while, Callahan's cognition was firmly in control of his actions. Hunger is one of the most powerful of all emotions. The survival experts call it food stress. Although the body can go perhaps 3 weeks without food, the emotional drive is immense and becomes an obsession, a drive as strong as any fight or flight response. It can't be ignored. People, of course, will kill for food. Remark wrote, "The corned beef over there is famous along the whole front. Occasionally, it has been the chief reason for a flying raid on our part." My father told me of lying broken and near death in the Nazi prison camp and still having elaborate food fantasies. Major Gene M. Lam, an Army physician who was a Korean prisoner of war, put it this way in John Leach's Survival Psychology. Regardless of what it is, eat it. One of the basic principles of survival medicine is to eat. If you miss one meal as a prisoner, it will take you weeks to regain your lost strength. He described maggots found in rotten fish as being quite good. Callahan had salvaged some raisins from Solo, but they became waterlogged and rotted. The stems are slimy and bitter. I eat them anyway. When Callahan realized that he might use his spear gun, by chance he'd bought it in the Canaries and stashed it in his survival pack, to catch the dorados that swarmed around his raft, he went a little crazy with craving. But he stopped himself before taking action. Wait, what if it is a strong fish? I hurriedly tie a piece of line through the gun handle and onto the raft. My stomach growls. 4 days on a pound of food. I'm trembling with excitement. He remembered to monitor the sea so that his weight at the edge of the raft didn't capsize him. Then he took his time. The spear gun was not much more than a toy, but it saved his life. Callahan began talking to the fish. "You get into some really crazy thinking," Ken Killip told me 30 months after his own rescue from Rocky Mountain National Park. "But it's not crazy. It's normal survivor behavior." Killip began feeding his rations to the marmots in Rocky Mountain National Park just to get them to come close. He talked to them as well. Christopher Burney kept a pet snail in Buchenwald. When the soup came, I gave the snail little pieces of cabbage. So the behavior Tom Hanks portrayed in the movie Castaway, talking to a volleyball, while it was taken a bit too far by the Hollywood types, was still based on reality, the acceptance of our world. We are social animals, and whoever is present is our society. We must love, and what we love, we take into our bodies. Callahan loved his dorados even as he ate them. Survivors develop a mantra. It can be anything. Callahan's seems to have been nothing more than the word survival itself. Over and over again, he'd say something like, "Concentrate on now, on survival." Yossi Ginsberg, the Israeli hiker, wrote that in the early moments of impact when his raft was swept away in a raging river, spitting him out and stranding him for 3 weeks in the Bolivian jungle, he began telling himself, "Don't cry, don't break now, be a man of action." When I found myself feeling hopeless, I whispered my mantra, "Man of action, man of action." I don't know where I had gotten the phrase. I repeated it over and over. A man of action does whatever he must, isn't afraid, and doesn't worry. Callahan, like the rest of us, was dogged by faulty technology. His solar stills, devices for distilling water from the moisture in the air, wouldn't work. The inner tube raft began cracking long before he was through with it, and the waterproof covering had begun to disintegrate. The rain poured in on him, and what water the canopy could catch was contaminated and not drinkable. Trying to swallow it is like forcing down another man's vomit. I curse it. Who makes those things? Certainly not someone who has tested them in the ocean for months at a time. And his was a 6-man raft considered extravagant for his solo voyage. He couldn't even lie down in it, but had to sleep curled up. Only by constant and very clever tinkering was Callahan able to survive using his so-called professional survival gear, caveat emptor. But survival is an act of art and craftsmanship. It involves the order of craft and the spontaneous invention of art. The more Callahan accepted his new world as normal, the more he embraced it with the willing, thinking part of his mind. The trick is to own the world and to let it own you, to come quite literally to terms. Hence he named the dorados his doggies. He called the triggerfish butlers because they have that starched collar look. He named his raft Rubber Ducky, and the place where he hung up the strips of fish to dry he called the butcher shop. But part of accepting the world is retaining selfhood, knowing your own inner needs, especially the need for rest and relief. Even in short-term survival situations, Memory becomes a tremendous resource for salving the spirit, finding place. Remark describes how, in the midst of a mortar attack, I see a picture, a summer evening. I am in the cathedral cloister and look at the tall rose trees that bloom in the middle of the little cloister garden where the monks lie buried. A great quietness rules in this blossoming quadrangle. The sun lies warm on the heavy gray stones. I place my hand upon them and feel the warmth. The image is alarmingly near. It touches me before it dissolves in the light of the next star shell. Callahan wrote, "The sun sizzling overhead roasts my dry skin. I envision myself sprawled on an Antiguan beach. In a moment I will rise and fetch a cold rum punch. No need to yet. Plenty of time." He recognized the need for escape. "I want desperately to keep these other worlds safe from pain and depression so that I can escape to them whenever I wish. My own propaganda is intoxicating." A survival situation brings out the true underlying personality. Our survival kit is inside us, but unless it's there before the accident, it's not going to appear magically at the moment it's needed. When you consolidate your personality as a survivor, what you get is the essence of what you always had. A survival situation simply concentrates who you are. It drives the natural system you've developed over a lifetime, and it drives it harder. Whether or not it becomes chaotic at the boundaries depends on what you've put into it over a lifetime. Your experiences, education, family, and way of viewing the world all shape what you would be as a survivor. After experiencing a hurricane as a child, Callahan put together a survival kit with money, a knife, fishing tackle, and a few other things. "If anyone survived, it would be me," he told himself. Also, he was once bedridden due to blood poisoning when he was a teenager, but exhibited a survivor's attitude even at the age of 16. "Instead of dwelling on my ailment, I told myself that at least I still had a clear head, strong arms, and one good leg." Survival had always been part of Callahan's way of life. Those are the people who survive best. Others require rescue and a great deal of luck. In the hurricane, in the sailing he'd done, Callahan had experienced forces that could kill him, so he was a believer. He had an artistic, craftsman-like temperament. He had patience and humility. He was meticulous, a perfectionist. He had spent a lifetime building a survival raft that didn't leak. Survivors find wealth and happiness in the smallest things. They never say, "Why me?" or "I can't take it anymore." When his raft leaked and he was sinking, with seawater destroying his precious cache of dried fish, Callahan spent 8 days tinkering together a patch that worked. He drove himself to complete exhaustion and had to beat off shark attacks at the same time. But coming up out of sleep the morning after his 1,000th failure, a voice in his head told him, "I want to live, to live, to live." When at last he succeeded, after many more hours of maddening work, as well as divine mechanical and engineering inspiration involving a fork, no less, he wrote, "My body hungers, thirsts, and is in constant pain. But I feel great. I have finally succeeded." He wasted no energy on anything but positive, forward motion. He rarely slipped back or questioned the fates. Only occasionally did he consider giving up what he called his pointless struggle. Most of the time he rose to each challenge with a big heart, bursting with enthusiasm. It was his 53rd day adrift. Like all true survivors, Callahan was doing it not just for himself. Survivors are always connected to loved ones, friends, society. They survive because they are rescuing the species, not just themselves. It's another paradox of survival. The individual doesn't matter. But the survival instinct of the individual must matter if the species is to survive. That's one reason survivors do it for another. Callahan was sustained by thoughts of his mother. "You had better not give up that easily," his mother told him once when she was worried about his sailing habit. You have to promise me to hang on as long as you can. I remember asking my father what his first thoughts were when his plane was hit. I was probably 10 years old. He told me he thought of his mother, then my mother, and the pain they were both going to feel. He said he was intent on the question of how he was going to get back to them to prevent that pain. Callahan constantly reminded himself of the basic things, the important things. The important thing is to keep calm. I can only afford success. Don't hurry. Make it right. Patience is going to be the secret, and strength. At the heart of his magnificent survival is what I had gone looking for, the beautiful thing contained in that dull military locution, positive mental attitude. I am constantly surrounded by a display of natural wonders. It is beauty surrounded by ugly fear. I write in my log that it is a view of heaven from a seat in hell. The Stoics are the best survival instructors. As Epictetus wrote, "On occasion of every accident, event that befalls you, remember to turn to yourself and inquire what power you have for turning it to use. The secret is to meet adversity head on." When his spear gun lost its elastic motor, which spelled death for Callahan if he couldn't fix it, he reflected, "It's always a challenge to try and repair an essential system with what one has at hand. In many ways, having a jury rig succeed is often more gratifying." Callahan provides a rare example of the completely consolidated personality. In these moments of peace, deprivation seems a strange sort of gift. My plight has given me a strange kind of wealth, the most important kind. I value each moment that is not spent in pain, desperation, hunger, thirst, or loneliness. Even here there is richness all around me. As I look out of the raft, I see God's face in the smooth waves, His grace in the Dorado's swim, feel His breath against my cheek as it sweeps down from the sky. He sees a rainbow and writes, "I feel as if I am passing down the corridor of a heavenly vault of irreproducible grandeur and color." He saw that to lose everything at the edge of such a glorious eternity is far sweeter than to win by plodding through a cautious, painless, and featureless life. And that, of course, is why people undertake adventures such as solo voyages of the Atlantic to begin with. The true survivor isn't someone with nothing to lose. He has something precious to lose. But at the same time, he's willing to bet it all on himself. And it makes what he has that much richer. Days stolen are always sweeter than days given. By the 65th day, Callahan was advancing closer and closer to death. His amazing abilities, strength, and determination had slowed the process considerably, but no one lives forever, not even the best survivor. Sometimes the process can go for an ungodly long time, as was the case with Shoichi Yokoi, a sergeant in the Japanese Imperial Army who hid out in the jungle when the Americans won the island of Guam in 1944. Telling himself, "I am living for the Emperor," he survived on his own until he was found in 1972. When at last Callahan reached the Caribbean Islands on April 21, 1982, having made a successful solo crossing of the Atlantic, minus his boat, a fishing skiff was attracted to his raft because of the birds flying over it, who were after the school of Dorados Callahan had herded across the Atlantic. The fisherman, seeing his condition, offered to take him to land. He said, "No, I'm okay. I have plenty of water. I can wait. You fish. Fish." And he waited, drinking his hoarded water. By that time he had plenty, and watching their joy in fishing those great shimmering Dorados. He drank 5 pints while watching, having stayed on a ration of 1/2 pint a day for 76 days. 13. The Sacred Chamber. 2 British mountaineers, Joe Simpson and Simon Yates, had decided to make a first ascent of the 4,500-foot southwest face of the 21,000-foot Sierra Grande, a mountain in the Cordillera Huayhuash of the Peruvian Andes. They achieved the summit in May 1985 and were on the very difficult descent when Simpson broke his leg. He was above 19,000 feet on a completely uninhabited, snow-covered mountain in Peru. He knew that Yates couldn't pull him up on the rope that connected them. It was an impossibility of physics. Even as Simpson hung there, upside down after his fall, he thought, "I've broken my leg. That's it. I'm dead. Everyone said it. If there's just two of you, a broken ankle could turn into a death sentence." At first, as he described later in his book, Touching the Void, Simpson began to follow the common pattern of reaction to catastrophe, denial. He told himself that the leg wasn't really broken, it was only sprained. That thought came unbidden, even as he was seeing the kink in the joint and knew the impact had driven my lower leg up through the knee joint. Simpson was splitting into two people. One perceived the reality, the other denied it. Reason and emotion. Then hot waves of emotion poured over him, and tears of self-pity streamed down. Within moments he had gone through denial to anger. "I felt like screaming, and I felt like swearing." You mustn't linger too long in any but the last of Kubler-Ross's stages, which is a yin-yang stage that can be either resignation or determination. Joe Simpson had to do something to stop his descent toward death. He knew he had screwed up big time. Then something in him clicked. He stayed silent. If I said a word, I would panic. I could feel myself on the edge of it. He stopped the progression through the stages of dying at that moment. He took cognitive control. He had successfully put his thinking brain in balance with his emotional brain so that the two could help him to function. He didn't know how he was doing that. He didn't have to know. Neither did he know what Yates would do, probably leave him. Simpson simply took charge of the things within his power, namely himself, and left the rest behind. By the time Yates peered over the ridge, Simpson was right side up, both mentally and physically, and calmly told his partner, "I've broken my leg." Although Simpson could see the change in Yates's expression, all Yates said was, "Are you sure it's broken?" "Yes." Without batting an eye, Yates said, "I'll abseil down to you," and began working on an improvised anchor for the rappel. Of course, dozens of thoughts and emotions were powering through both their minds at that point, and Yates knew, too, how close to death Simpson was. His immediate thought was, "You're fucked, matey. You're dead." But neither of them said a thing. They simply set to work. Yates wasn't going to leave him. He, too, was going to do what was in his power, nothing less, nothing more. "It was all totally rational," Yates said later. "I knew where we were. I took in everything around me instantly and knew he was dead. I accepted without question that I could get off the mountain alone." Al Siebert, in his book The Survivor Personality, writes that the best survivors spend almost no time, especially in emergencies, getting upset about what has been lost or feeling distressed about things going badly. For this reason, they don't usually take themselves too seriously and are therefore hard to threaten. Yates rappelled down to Simpson and examined him. He gave him some pain medicine. Neither spoke. As Simpson put it, "In an instant, an uncrossable gap had come between us." They were both working on shifting decisions out of the amygdala and into the neocortex. In such a dire emergency, the amygdala would urge instant action without thought. It has the chemical authority to do that, too. So it takes energy, balance, and concentration to shift control to the executive functions of the neocortex. Simpson and Yates didn't want to upset that delicate balance with any extraneous inputs. Simpson understood it, too, and explained, "It felt as if I was holding something terrifyingly fragile and precious." They both instinctively recognized their need for privacy in their individual struggles for survival, those critical moments of consolidation. Each man must do his own surviving. He may do it by rescuing someone else, by not being a victim. But just as only he can live his life, so too his survival cannot be shared. No one can do it for him. Privacy is important for strength in that lonely work.